Well, we want to certainly wish you God's blessing tonight. I'm glad to be able to see this congregation here. It's been a little while since we were among you, and we've had a lot of experiences since we saw you last. And we have two messages here that are rather important, and we were asked to bring these, and it's very similar to a study that we were doing over the ministers meeting in Mendon, Ohio these past few days. But we're going to try not to say anything here that we said over there. In case you've already heard those themes or can get a hold of those, you won't have to listen to the same thing twice. So we'll try to bring you something a little different these two sessions. So I'd like to ask two questions and answer them tonight and tomorrow morning. So the question that we're asked to speak about was, is it possible to help restore people with broken relationships, people that have difficulties in life? You heard the word there, hurts. Is it possible to restore those people? How do you do that? And so this evening I thought we'd ask another question first. It's a very simple question, and it can be a little intimidating, but the question is, why are there hurting people? And we're not going to be able to answer that question in its entirety. Why are there hurting people? And may I say this, to surprise you just a little bit, there are probably many hurting people in the world who would not have to be. Now, does anyone know why I said that? There are probably many, many hurting people who would not have to be. And may I say it another way? The smaller you are, the less you'll be hurt. Big people are hurt. Little people hardly are. That's a very important thing to keep in mind on this whole matter here of helping hurting people. But there are hurting people, and we want to be honest about that. We certainly find that in the New Testament, Jesus came to heal and to restore, and restores man in his three parts that he has, that you and I have, spirit, soul, and body. Jesus came to work on all three of those, and we have that in the Bible several times where that is said. I'm not going to take time to look at his verses. We looked at those this week. But he came to work on the spirit of man, his spirit, the spiritual person, the mental and emotional part of man, his soul, and also his spiritual needs. So there are spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical sicknesses, physical illnesses. Now, I wanted to tell you that not all mental and emotional illnesses are necessarily pathological. That is, they're not necessarily a physical cause, not always. Some mental illnesses could be caused by accident or by infection, but a lot of mental and emotional struggle and illness and problem and hurt does not come from anything pathological. It comes from something psychosomatic. And so it comes because of things that are happening to them, experiences they're going through, and their reactions to it, not necessarily from something physical that took place in their life. Jesus willingly healed all those things. Some of us have had all three of those areas, all three of those problems. As far as I remember, in my years of ministry, I think only one time did we have a healing or anointing service, James 5, anointing service, for someone with mental and emotional problems. Almost every time we've had an anointing service, in my experience, it's been with a physical ailment of some kind. But we did it once with a young mother who had serious emotional problems. And there may have been some other oppressions that went along with that. On a Sunday night church service, the ladies sat on this side of the meeting house, and the men sat on this side, and she was sitting right at the very edge of the bench in the middle. And she stood up to say something, and she was very distressed. She was very alarmed. She was very overcome with things there. And when she was done speaking, she fell down on the floor and was stretched out like a plank, stretched out like a railroad tie. If you had picked her up by her ankles on this side and by the back of her head on this side, I don't think she would have sagged a half an inch when they picked her up. She just was stiff as a heavy piece of lumber. And they took her back and put her in the nursery. There was nothing physically wrong with her. She was very, very healthy. We had anointing service for her. As far as I know, she was never bothered with that problem again the rest of her life, up until now. But it was the most beautiful, experience to see the change in that lady. In this study, we will not focus on physical health needs, as most of you here this evening are well acquainted with and well understand such things as cancer and accidents and heart disease and COVID and kidney failure and other debilitating infirmities. You know about those things. We won't take time to look at that. But what is it that causes mental illness, emotional breakdown, hurt people, and as the New Testament tells us, the bruised? That word bruised, as used in Greek, means to smite through, to shatter, broken by calamity. I think our Spanish Bible has a very accurate translation for that word distressed. It says, the oppressed. This is found in Jesus' announcement in Luke chapter 4 concerning the reason for his ministry, to set at liberty those that are bruised, those that are oppressed. Jesus ministered to these needs. Yet we might not be able, with our limited understanding, to figure out, to walk beside, to truly share in the experience of the people who are struggling, who have fear or anxiety, understand the brokenness that causes intense suffering. We might not be able to understand it. We'd like to understand a little better before the night's over. Nor do I want to be psychological about this theme. These things that we're talking about require more than a scientific answer, more than a pill to swallow, more than some kind of potion. They need a spiritual answer. But we must admit that these hurts, these offenses are all around us. But why are there hurting people? That's the question for tonight. Why are there? And so you may want to open your Bible with me. I'm going to read several verses here. The Bible is filled with verses like this. And in both Testaments, we'll read some of these tonight. We'll read more of them tomorrow morning. But I'd just like to look at how important this theme is in your Bible. It's all over the Scripture. Luke chapter 4, verse 18 and 19. This is Jesus in the synagogue on the Sabbath day, reading from the prophet Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. That's what Jesus said he came for. And of course, it goes without me needing to tell you, remind you of this, that that's what Jesus came for, and he left and sent the Holy Ghost of God to be his advocate for us and in us, called the Comforter here this evening. That's because he wants us to continue what he started. That's what we are here for today, to do that, what he was doing there. If you go to Matthew 8, we have this interesting quotation here from the Old Testament. And we'll read verses 16 and 17. When the even was come, they brought unto him many that were possessed with devils. And he cast out the spirits with his word, and healed all that were sick, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, himself took our infirmities and bare our sicknesses. That's found in Isaiah 53. We can go back to Hebrews chapter 12. If you can do that yet, we'll look at this these two verses, verses 12 and 13. We can read a larger portion. This is enough to get the point. Where the admonition is, wherefore lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. And that verse 13 tells you that there are two options. Either to be healed, or if not, something's going to probably go astray here. Someone's going to be turned out of the way. Someone's going to go astray. Let them rather be healed. That would be a better option. That's what it ought to be. So let's get started with this theme. And again, as the brother told you, if you have any questions about some of these things, you can just jot them down there. I see some of you are writing already, but if you have some questions, write them. Maybe we can take a look at some of those tomorrow afternoon. Who are the deeply hurt and oppressed people of our time? Who would they be? It might be someone sitting very close to you. It might be someone in your family. There are certainly many of these people all around us. So the answer to this question is very broad. We're only going to be able to just touch a few major points, and there's much that I'm sure that I will overlook, and maybe we'll catch some of it tomorrow in the morning. But it's certainly going to be a broad answer. Who are these deeply hurt people? There may be, on one hand, those with relatively normal emotional stresses, like worry. If you think it's necessary to worry, there's certainly a lot of that. There's worry, there's uncertainty. There are issues that we cannot resolve, and that's probably one of the hardest things for most of you sitting here. When you have a problem in life, and try as you may, you cannot fix it. Your problem might be with another person, and try as you might, you haven't found a way to resolve it. And an unresolved problem wears us out. An unresolved problem is a cause of tremendous emotional energy loss. Call it whatever you want to call it. You just cannot fix it. No matter what you try to do, it stays the same. Another thing that causes these rather normal emotional struggles is busyness, overload, too much. Now, we have some very strong men in this audience. And if I would give some of these strong young fellows a brick and tell them to hold that brick out there like that, well, it'd be nothing. They could do that easily. When I was young and feeding the chickens, we used to do that with 2 5-gallon buckets. I'd fill them both full of feed, and I'd walk out to the chicken yard from the feed barrel and hold those two buckets out like that and carry it out to the chickens. And you can teach yourself to do that too. You might not be able to start with a full bucket, but if you make it half full and then I keep adding, you'll soon be able to do it. But take that brick and hold it out there. You say, that's easy. Well, then do it for 15 minutes. And you find out that you can't do it. That just will start to go down. So any amount of weight, you might be able to handle it for a little bit. How many 100 pounds of feet can you carry your back at one time? Well, some of you would carry 300 pounds and not worry about it, but not very far. I saw a man carry a 100-pound bag of beans out of a field way back in the bushes in Nicaragua, a field he had way back in. He had a donkey. He put one bag on the donkey's back. He put the other one on his back. He picked up the rope and led the donkey down and around and across the river to the far side. And it was about a mile or further before he got to the road. He carried that 100-pound bag of feed on his back, and the donkey carried his. The donkey had 4 legs to do it. He only had 2. I remember seeing what happened when he got to the road. When he got to the road, he just slowly leaned front until that fell off his shoulders. He was not strong enough to lift it off. And then when that was off of him, he went back and under the donkey, grabbed the rope, and walked back in again to get the next 2 bags. We can carry a lot of weight for a while. Emotionally, it's the same way. You can carry an X amount of emotional struggle, financial loss, bills that must be paid, something that's coming up, an emergency that took place, you weren't anticipating this. And that overload comes. That's a cause of very, very normal emotional struggles, and all of us face some of that. You cannot avoid that in life. Those overloads come. Then we move on to more serious conditions, like nervous energy deficiency. It just is not there. You can't keep up your end of it. You've had all you could handle. You're wore out and tired. It's only 8 o'clock in the morning. And there's such a thing as rejection. That's a bad one. Which, of course, is isolation and loneliness. Then there are phobias. And, of course, that's from a Greek word translated in your King James Version with such words as alarm, fright, exceedingly afraid, terror. All those words in the New Testament, the King James Version, are translated from the Greek word phobios, which is where we get our word phobia. Things that we're afraid of, things that distress us, things that we can hardly handle. Exceedingly afraid. Alarm, fright. Those things bother us. And then we move on to deeper problems. Depression, paranoia, and then into the serious levels of psychotic behavior, where one may become dangerous to himself and or to others. If you don't know what psychosis is, psychotic behavior, it would be very similar to your word, insanity. And this level will take us beyond our study for today. We're not going to go into that one. How do we identify those needs that are around us and among us? What happened? What's taking place here? Well, we may find those that How do we identify that a person is affected by this kind of struggle? That's what I'm trying to tell you. How can we figure out that this person or that one, this one in my family, is someone that I learned to know on the job site? How do we know that that person is coping with these difficulties in his life? So that's what I'd like to answer here, or look at that. And again, these answers will be very limited, but enough to give you an idea of what we're talking about. You'll find those people around you who cannot handle authority in their lives. They resist authority in their lives. I will just say this about authority, and this is not the subject. All I'm doing is using that one illustration to tell us that people with some of these emotional and mental struggles really have trouble with authority. And I want to say this, that I don't want you to forget. Those who are in authority, who are not under authority, will lose their authority. But did you get that? Is that clear enough? So you're a father, you're an employer, you're a pastor. So you have authority. You're a mother, you're a school teacher. But if you're not under authority, while you are in authority, you're not under authority, you will lose the authority that you have. That's just such an important understanding. Please get that clear in your mind. That's the way it works. Some of these people who have trouble with authority, they feel very uneasy around their own parents, feel very uneasy around a pastor, possibly. They may lack social skills. They may find communication quite difficult. They just cannot express themselves well. And my heart goes out to anybody who cannot express himself well. My heart goes out to anybody that has trouble with stuttering. Anybody who has enough of neurosis because of things that have happened in his life that he cannot look at the people he's talking to. We're working with a lady right now. She's not from our congregation. I've only ever seen her look at one person that I've ever seen her talk to. If she's talking to this young man here in the front, she's talking to him like this, and she will not look at him. And she talks very quietly, and you can hardly hear what she says. She doesn't have a microphone on, but she will not look at him. If she's talking to this row of people, her head will probably be down further yet. There's a problem. I've seen her look at a person one time since I know her when she spoke. People that talk with their hands in their mouth, they're telling you something about themselves. You know, like the little three-year-old that thinks that when her eyes are shut, you cannot see her. It's just the way life is. And we're just proving who we are without making an announcement. But it's very clear. Communication is difficult. These dear people, when they're with others, no matter how many people are present, a church service at 6:30 on a Saturday night, they cannot truly fellowship with others, although there may be quite a few other people around. They find themselves on the fringes of the church and on the very edges of her positions. They keep things hidden from others, things in there that they don't ever want you to find out about. They feel that people are against them and they cannot trust. And what I just said there at the last is one of the major things to think about when it comes to emotional struggles, mental weaknesses, cannot trust. And this list is very, very long. There may be addictions in the life. And those addictions can include a lot of things. I think most of you are conscious these days of sexual addiction. We probably have much more trouble with that in our churches than we do alcoholism or drugs. There are all kinds of other addictions too. Eating is an addiction. There are other addictions. Working with a young lady who cannot face life, and so she spends the day in bed. It's a hideaway place. It's a safe place. No one's looking in the door. She's in there alone. But not quite, because she's in that bed with a dog. There's a dog in there with her. And she's 23 years old, but lying in bed with a doggy. Can you tell there's something wrong there, or can't you tell that? There's difficulty there. But this matter of trying to avoid people, hide, get away, we can't feel comfortable, we don't feel at home, we don't feel included, we don't feel wanted. There are addictions in life. There can be a desire for attention. This is very, very common. School teachers see this in some of their students. A desire for acceptance, a desire for praise. An intense desire to always be right, cannot be corrected, cannot help them see that they made a mistake here, cannot help them understand that there would have been a better way to do that. Even when your best intentions are to make them more productive, more fruitful, more useful in their lives, but they cannot accept correction, they are right, and they will let you know that and defend and justify and explain themselves and make it clear that this was the right thing to do. An intense desire to be always right. And so being that way, they strongly resist correction. By the time we get that far in the evening, you know that we're looking at more than a mental problem here. We're looking at spiritual problems, are we not? There's a faith problem here. There's a worship problem here. This is a person seeking to preserve themselves, to defend themselves, to maintain their integrity somehow, to convince themselves in light of what they think is being done against them preserve their integrity. So obviously, in a case like this, you're going to have a problem with brotherhood. Anyone in a condition like that is not going to flow well with the congregation. They're not going to live well in the church. It's not going to go well in the brotherhood. And that's a very sad thing, because the brotherhood should be the most healing community possible that's available to that dear person. Now, okay, so little Kendra is sitting there on Daddy's lap. At least that's where she was. And Brother Daniel, your daughter has no problem whatsoever trusting you. She's not afraid that she sits there. You're going to drop her. She has no fear whatsoever. You're going to let her fall down the steps when you're carrying her down there. She's not one bit worried that you're going to do anything wrong or ill to her. She trusts you perfectly. That's the way it is today. You believe that, don't you? And probably the little girl beside you feels the same way about you. But there's this perfect trust there. So whether it's trust, something else immediately follows that. This little girl trusts you. Your wife trusts you. And so immediately, we can say that same phrase another way. They have faith in you. They only trust you. They don't only trust you for what's going on now, the present moment. But they can look out across the future, although their minds don't think like this, but they can go out across the future and say, it's going to be okay if he does it, because I have faith in him. So what we have here at the present moment gets transferred to a future situation. That's what faith does. The evidence of things not seen. The conviction and proof in the heart that this is what we can depend on, this is the predictable results you get out of a nuance wonder. That's faith. And it's there because trust is here now. So let's violate trust and see what happens. Do you get that? Now, the secret in child raising is to take the trust that you have at 1 year of age in daddy and mama and have that when they're 20. And never lose that. Never give them occasion to believe that you're not trustworthy. From now till they're 20. Of course, much longer than that, but that's enough for an illustration. Right now, you can't believe that guy's girl 20 years of age, so that's about as far as I can take you. But some of us know that children get older than that. That's trust. Important thing to maintain it. Right now, you're off to a good start. But the goal is to keep that. And so you should have a question this time, Danny. You should have a question. What is your question? Your question should be, Brother Dale, tell me, how might I lose it? That should be your question. So we're asking the question, why are there deeply hurt and oppressed people in our time? We find the more serious cases in prisons, in the drug culture, in marriage problems, in pornography, in sexual gratification, and alas, at last, in the mental wards. All of us that are sitting here that have any age at all about us have seen that. Some of us have experienced some of these things personally. Where then, again I ask this question, is the healing community, the community that's going to do something about this? Let's move on. How did these hurting people become like this? Now I want you to listen closely. Unless there was a serious genetic disorder, no one is born this way. Little Kendra was not born that way. Unless there would have been a serious genetic disorder when she was born, which there was not in your case. So where did it come from? How did they become like that? These things that we've been describing here so far this evening. When did this happen? Where did it happen? Why did it happen? You want to prevent that in your children. You want to prevent that in your new marriage situation. You want to prevent that with the new members you have coming into your church. You want to remember that with a family that moves down from Allen County or wherever they come from. You want to prevent that from happening. How are you going to do that? And we see needs like this in the Bible. This should not surprise us. The things I'm talking about, we see them in the Bible. I'll just give you some very, very brief introduction to it, and we're going to bounce off that and try to answer this question. An extreme case of this kind of problem in the Scriptures is the Gadarene demoniac. It was a very serious thing. He did not use any clothing. He was out there with chains dangling from his wrist. He was living in tombs. No man could tame him. I don't think anyone brought him any valentines on the 14th of February. I doubt if any Christmas gifts showed up outside the tomb for him to pick up. I don't suppose the chorus came and sang the Hallelujah chorus for him. I don't suppose anyone came out there to have a nice, pleasant Sunday afternoon visit with him. He was lonely. And he didn't live around people anywhere. And the amazing thing is that Jesus showed up there, and this man found himself face to face with Christ and did not run away. It's an amazing story. That man had serious problems. That's a very serious case of it. I don't think you have anything like that in Bern, maybe not even in Allen County. Or excuse me, this is Adam County, right? There's a milder case, although very, very serious, in the situation of the prodigal son. Did you get that? There's something very neurotic going on here. And of course, we heard these past few days over there in Minden, Ohio. But are we sure that the prodigal son was neurotic? What about that elder son? What was wrong there? Why art thou cast down in my soul, and why art thou disquieted within me? There's a person asking his own emotional makeup, his own soulish nature. What's wrong with you, sir? What's wrong with you, young lady? What's wrong with you, mother? Why art thou cast down, talking to himself? What's wrong with you, soul of mine? Why are you bothered by this? What's going on in your life? What has caused this? That question's in the Bible several times. Several times, in fact, in just one psalm. I'd like to read something for you. And why art thou disquieted within me? I'd like to read something to you that is extremely serious. These are serious emotional problems in this case. And you'll be surprised when you hear this read to you. So I'm not even going to tell you where it is. I'm just going to read it. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be sorrowful and very heavy. Then saith he unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me. Now stop there. I'm talking about who, by the way? This is Jesus. And those of you that were with us last week, you should have noticed by now a secret in Jesus' heart that he was hoping would help preserve him, sustain him, enable him at this very difficult moment. He was looking for the benefit of community, and he was denied it. He was looking for the benefit of being in a close proximity and a close relationship with people that cared and were there and available and understanding and sharing with that thing with him and carrying the load with him, so he did not have to do it by himself, and he was denied that. Three times. At the end of this message, I hope to explain to you the importance of what I just told you about Jesus. And if you forget it before you get there, I think you remember this passage, these two verses in Matthew 26, when I tell you what we're going to say at the end. And those verses, if you study them in the original language, they tell you that Jesus was at a very, very low emotional condition. I would not recommend that he stayed that way for very long. And as you find there in Luke Along about chapter 22, you find out that he prayed through it. He came through that thing victoriously. The angels came and ministered to him. And this thing was totally surrendered and resigned to God. And he stepped up to the plate there, as they say in America. And he faced those people that were coming towards him. And asked them, are you looking for somebody? Did you come to find somebody? Jesus dealt with these matters in people's lives. He understood it on all points, tempted like as we are, yet without sin. He understood these things very well. Listen to this verse from Matthew chapter 4. And his fame went throughout all Syria. And they brought unto him all sick people that were taken with divers diseases and torments, and those that were possessed with devils, and those which were lunatic, that's psychotic. And those that had palsy, and he healed them. Jesus dealt with that. And there is the reality of satanic oppression or demonic possession. Jesus dealt with that. We had it right here in this passage I just read. When he came down from the Mount of Transfiguration, he ran into this situation. And when they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man, this is 17 Matthew, kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is lunatic and sore vexed. For oft times he falleth into the fire, oft into the water. And I brought him to thy disciples, and they could not cure him. Then Jesus answered and said, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him hither to me. Where did this problem in this young man begin? How did that happen? So we want to explore this journey just a little bit. At the risk of repeating myself, I'm going to review a story that has much to bear with this problem. You will recognize immediately when you hear this story that it's not true. And I don't like to tell stories that are not true or that I cannot prove that are factual. And usually I don't tell stories unless it's something that happened to myself or that I'm personally acquainted with. In this case, this story is not true. At the same time, there's a reason why I'm telling you this story. Because it could not be truer than what it is. It's very true. Now that I whet your curiosity, we'll see if you can follow along why I said there's two things. It's not a true story, but the meaning of it is very true. That's what I'm trying to say. So you people don't go to public high school, you don't go to college, and so you don't have this part on your mindscape. But this school had a football team, and this boy had applied for the team. He went to tryouts. And he got himself a uniform, and he never missed a practice. He was always there. And this boy was out on the gridiron. They were out there trying to train him how to catch a ball, how to pass one, kick one, how to block, how to tackle, do something to make a defense on the gridiron. He couldn't do it. He was a very poor player. He was not worth his salt. There's no reason to put him out there in the game. He's the best player that the opponent team had. You can't put him on the field. And this boy just could not get it. He did not miss practice. He always came with his uniform on. He always had everything ready to go, but he could not play football. We're getting close to the end of the season. Championship game's coming up. And right before the most important game of the season, the young man's father died. So now we have the game, and the young boy's sitting on the bench there. While the team's out there playing, he's taking his elbow and nudging the coach and saying, let me play. And the coach says, I can't. This is a seasonal game. We've got to win this thing. Let me play. Finally, the coach had pity on him. His father just died. 5 minutes won't hurt too much. So he told him to go out there and take that young man's place. He came in. He went out. The coach watched from the sidelines, could not believe what he saw. This boy put everything he could into this game. It was amazing, his performance out there. Coach called him back to the sidelines. Son, what's going on? I have never seen you play like this. Where did you learn this? What are you doing? I have never. Well, coach, don't you understand? My daddy was blind. This is the first game he ever saw me play. Now, did you get that? Is it true or not? It's extremely true. Right there is the problem. Right there. If I would tell you that I preached for 27 years before my father ever heard one sermon, that would help you understand something. Dad is involved with something else. The young man in the home is on his own. Or the daughter. No one watches me play. And please understand something. That story has nothing to do with how professional you are, how skilled you are, how superlative you are, how much an outstanding player you are. You don't have to be a varsity. You don't have to be an all-star. Your child doesn't need to hear all that praise. Your child doesn't need to hear you say, hey, 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 you did it, the touchdowns, the this, the that. We have a young man in our congregation that has a lot of struggles. So at the school picnic, they were playing a game of softball, and when this boy came up to the bat, he'd hit that ball, and his mother, who knows about the boy's problems, was just cheering him and encouraging him and calling out his name. And so I walked over and stood beside her. I said, I appreciate how you encouraged your son for the way he caught that ball or the way he hit that thing. He hit it way out there to center field. But I said, Mama, let me tell you something. Be sure you do the same thing if he strikes out. Don't be afraid to watch your son play. Don't be afraid to encourage him. If there was some mistakes along the way, he still needs a mama. He still needs someone who cares. He still needs the approbation. He still needs assurance. He still needs some kind of confirmation that it was okay. Mom and daddy said so. But if a child doesn't have that from little on up, something will take the place of it. They don't have you, daddy. They'll find somebody else. I hate to tell you who they might find, but they'll find somebody else. It's a need for the child to have a heart of his father. Close ties with home. The issue is not the son's superlative performance. It's not how well he did the game. Not how well he does what he knows to do. It's simply to know that daddy cares. It's the cry of a son to have his daddy near. To hear his approbation. To hear his affirmation. To hear him say, well done, son. I really appreciate being here. Why don't we stop for ice cream on the way home? I'm sorry. That's where it's missed. Right there. From age 3 and up. Although emotional and mental illness is basically a religious problem, a lack of or else a faulty faith, it does not begin there. Trust is violated first. Trust arises from good relationships with others. So the cause of the offense or the hurt is broken relationships where they are needed most. And that is in the family. I'll tell you this little story. This is a true story. I was there when it happened. I was preaching We're in Indiana. It was in a neighboring state. It was not in Tennessee. And they had some kind of a store or something down there, and our steps went up, and there was an apartment up top there. So they put us up there to stay for that week we were there. And there was no wheelchair back in those days. And one day they told me there's a young lady coming to see us. She's having intense struggles emotionally and so on. She's just beside herself. She's not doing well. Would you visit with this young lady when she comes? Yes, she may come. And she came up the steps. So my wife and I were sitting over the couch. And right over here there was a sofa chair. Like a single sofa chair. Soft furniture. It had an armrest on it. And so she sat there, and she was kind of nervous, and she was, trying to present herself and pose a little bit. She was trying to. I said, "I'm very happy that you came, young lady." I said, "I just have to ask you a question." This was right at the very beginning of the interview. I said, "I'm going to take a chair and sit it on your left side." I'm going to set a chair there beside your sofa on the left. I'm going to ask you to take your arm and lay it down on the armrest of your sofa. And then we got to invite your father to come up the steps. He's going to sit in the chair to your left. And while he is sitting there and we're visiting, he's going to reach out his hand and put it on top of your wrist. I didn't get that far. And here's what happened. She jerked her hand off of there as if she was experiencing it at that very moment. She jerked that hand right off of there. I think she surprised herself. But it was so graphic she couldn't help it. He would not be touching her hand or her wrist. Not my dad. Well, I'll stop there. Daddy, do you want to try that? And see how that works in your home? And would you tell me what was going on in that relationship between father and daughter? That I saw that in front of my eyes with my wife sitting beside me? What is wrong here? Little Kendra would not jerk herself away from her daddy. That girl didn't either when she was 1 year old. Brother Mose, what do you plan to do about that? I don't know what all of your names are, so I won't call your name out. I don't know who you are, so it'll be okay. But there's a problem. And something that's very seriously wrong started somewhere. Trust arises from good relationships with others. So the cause of the offense, the hurt, is some kind of a broken relationship where it's needed most, in this case with daddy. Instead of consistent love or affection or words of approval, honesty and security. Now listen closely. You did not expect me to say this. Honesty and security, that is a security that provides discipline and helpful criticism for your child. If your child is not in a secure place, if your child does not trust you, if your child does not feel at home in your presence, if your child does not know that you have his or her good in mind, if your child has not learned by now that daddy's main interest is my well-being, you can get the rod out. You can sit them down and give them a talking to. You can give them some kind of rebuke, reproach. You can try to correct them in something they've done. Criticize them in some way. It will not work. But when there's security and trust and confidence in father or the school teacher or the pastor, you can do that in a way that the child says, Oh, I think I understand that. And then you see the child, regardless of how old they are, whether they're 5 years old or whether they're 15, you see down the road that they benefited from that correction. They benefited from that word that you gave to them. And instead of saying, about time he caught a hold, I thought it was about time he gets it. See if he can behave from now on. Sorry, Daddy. We're not going to get anywhere. But you walk up to that young man and you say, son, I'm just very happy to see how you're responding. It's a real joy to have a son like you. We're going on this way together. You can count on me. I'll be here when you have needs. We'll walk through it together. Now, I never had the experience as a boy. I don't know what that would have been like to have a father like that. That must be a wonderful thing to be able to live with that. I would certainly recommend that for all the children in this congregation. Don't you think so? And the young ladies as well. You see, love, affection, intense interest in your child does not mean that you don't discipline them. It does not mean that you don't correct them when it's time to do that. But in this spirit, and in this way, the broken home contains lovelessness, alcohol, divorce, infidelity, addiction, crime. And you say, we have none of that in our family, nor in our congregation. Well then, let us humbly thank God. That's wonderful. But, brothers and sisters, is there in the home or in the church, in the school, is there favoritism? Is there criticism? Is there marriage tension? Is there little or no evidence of affection? Is there a controlling spirit? Is there in the home, in the congregation, a plague of anger? Did you ever see a bishop, an elder, standing in the brothers' meeting, a members' meeting, or looking down at the top of the glasses like that, and just vehement with anger? I've seen that. It's a terrible thing, or if it's a father, if it's a mother. Is there a father here tonight whose child or youth can never please him, no matter how hard they try? What happens to the one who can never measure up to what daddy expects, what mother demands? And in the father's mind, the mother's mind, they have another young person in the congregation, in the community in view, and they're comparing you or their child with that one over there. And they keep having ways to remind that child that there's no way that they're like that one. They never get accomplished what that one does. And that child is like a balloon deflated. Your child is not that child. Your child is your child. I'm going to say something else at this point. If you have three or four children, you will soon discover they're not all alike. Our children were very good students. They didn't have any trouble in school. Like that brilliant young girl we met last night that goes to the Keystone congregation, who really does not need a teacher. She learns so well. She gets her lessons almost by herself. That's where our children were. But then Gabriel came along. He couldn't get it in school. He couldn't read his lessons. He didn't know what the question said that he was supposed to answer. His mother tried and tried to help him do his homework. If she read it to him, he understood perfectly what it said. But he couldn't read it. He was way behind the other children. They were doing well by the time they were at that place in their school experience. He learned to read when he was in eighth grade, when his sister had him as a student. Way back in those days, he had what you call today dyslexia. At that time, nobody knew what it was. There was no help for it. No one knew what to do about it. His daddy had the same problem. I still have it. After a while, you learn how to overcome that. You learn how to use your mind to overcome the problem of the misreading that you're doing. It happens to me also when I'm writing. Same thing happens. Same problem. I'm writing a sentence, and I'm ready to write the next word. But all right, the word is coming two or three words down the line. I put that one in, and I missed the word that's supposed to be there next. Because the mind goes faster than what the eyes do or what the hand does, and so we just don't know where we are right now when we're reading that sentence. Those are things that happen. But that child of yours does not need to be like the rest. There's gifts in that child. There's a beauty in that child. There's a contribution that child will make. That child will do you a tremendous amount of good. And if it's not as good as the other one, it doesn't matter. He will be better in other areas. Bless that child. Let that child shine. Provide opportunities for that child to have a beautiful experience in your home. He doesn't have to match the rest of them. His value does not depend upon that. I put my wife to bed one night. And she told me this just today. She tried to get into bed by herself, and she said, "Daddy, could you cover me?" She can't cover herself. She didn't have enough strength in her arm to pull the covers up. So I pulled the covers up and put them under her chin. And then one night she said, "Oh, you have to do everything for me. I can't do anything for you." No one can go to sleep like that. No one can go to bed with that in their mind. I said to her, honey, you do far more for me than I ever do for you. Everyone counts. Everyone is worth a lot. Everyone is making a contribution. Everyone is needed. Even when they're singing happy birthday on the 5th of September, everyone can help. That's just the way it is. But we're looking at reasons why these problems grow up like that. Are the children forced to perform in order to gain favor? And I cannot exhaust that list of things that happen in a home that discourage children and let give them the impression they're not wanted, they're not accepted, their contribution does not count, they don't belong here. I can't go through all of that. There's often in these cases a lack of tenderness and warmth where these are needed the most in the family. And so to find healing, somebody must find a new family. One that I will call tonight a healing community, a healing family. That will probably need to be a spiritual family. Blessed is that person who finds this in the church, if home cannot supply it. Where a child is ridiculed, shamed, told to get out of here and never come back. And at the same time that that's going on, others are held high as achievers. Now, as Anabaptist, it is not popular to say what I'm going to say next, and I might receive criticism for it. But a child raised in this atmosphere will have his value of himself, have his worth, have his person seriously impaired. He doesn't have value. He's not worth anything. When this boy said, "I am no more worthy to be called thy son," I think that was probably his own estimation of his behavior, of his relationship with the home project and with his father. I would certainly choose to believe tonight that it wasn't the attitude that the father had imposed upon his son. I hope that that is not the impression that daddy gave to that boy. I'm no more worthy. But it's a loss of personhood. That's what that is. And so that you know that there's a biblical reason why I made that statement, I'm going to read to you from Romans chapter 12, verse 3. And you can think about this on your own. But it says here, "For I say through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith." There is a way we should think about ourselves. There is a right way to understand that there is a value, there is a contribution, there is a purpose for which I am here, there is some worth, there are some things that I can contribute. Every person needs to know that. Yes, you can think of yourself more highly than you should. That's wrong. That could be pride. That could be a lot of other things. It could be an attempt to get attention. That's pride. But I want to read you another verse. And these are words that Jesus said. These are in Matthew 22. You may want to turn there because I'm going to have a question for you when I read these verses. This is verses 36 to 40 in Matthew 22. It says here, "Master, which is the great commandment in the law?" And please pay close attention. These are verses that you know by heart, but you won't know this answer immediately without looking closely at these verses, though you know the verses by heart. Verse 37, "Jesus said unto him, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Now in those verses, a person's love is supposed to be directed three directions. What are the three directions? God, love God. Neighbor, love your neighbor. Love yourself. In fact, how are you supposed to love your neighbor? As yourself. I hate myself. I'm worthless. Dad said so. School teacher proved it to me. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Thank you. Now you see why I said that. And when you take a child and pull the rug out from under his personhood and deny him the dignity of being an individual, we have damaged something very severely. And that's the very fiber with which we live our Christian life. This is the greatest of all commandments. This is the way you live. This has got to be in place in your life. And in the home is where those pillars are established. It's in the home where that framework is put into a child. And little Kendra is not suffering any damage in that area whatsoever. Lily. Kendra is 12 years old and still wets the bed every night. Lily, what do you plan to do? And don't tell me there's no one in here who knows anything about that. It's one thing if you're the mother, the father of a child like that. It's far, far worse if you're the child. Guess how I know? And then you listen to the comments. You listen to what's talked about around the table when neighbors come, when people come from church for a meal. Guess what? The telltale signs are out there in the wash line. There's a sheet flowing out there in the breeze. Does anyone awake here tonight? Do these problems we're talking about have a source? It says there to love. It doesn't say to be in love. You're not in love with yourself. Do you get that? There's a difference there. And those we are learning to love have first of all loved us. None of us can truly love who have not been dearly loved. Tell me, what happens to a child from a church-going home who is put down, or ignored by his family, but who at the same time is highly respected and appreciated by the rest of society? What's going to happen to that child? And my life is a commentary on that question. There is this oft-repeated cycle. I'm going to write this in the board and see if I can find something that writes up here. They've got some things here. I don't know if it writes or not. We'll try it and see what goes. But here's an oft-repeated cycle. It's in four parts. Well, that's not going to work very well. You're not going to see that, are you? We'll try something else here. here's an oft-repeated cycle in four parts. It's written on the board there. You can read it. One is not truly loved by those who really should love him. So he learns to live without love. Then he is either unable or unwilling to ever receive love, if somebody would try it. And then he cannot love others, because you cannot love others until you've first been loved. This is all over the Bible. I'm not going to take the time to read those verses. We love him because he first loved us. You know that that is in there. You have to be loved before you can love. It's Lily and Dan's job to love Kendra, whether the bed is wet at 12 years of age or not. Love Kendra. If you don't love her, she will learn that she has to live without love. And she will gain her love. It won't be love, but it'll be applause or a fame or some kind of accreditation or some kind of recognition by her performance. She'll learn to do better than others do it. She'll learn to outdo dad and outdo mom. She'll figure out ways to do things that they do not know how to do. She will learn how to do things that they do not approve. But somebody will respect her for it, appreciate her for it, give her credit for it, laud her for it, and that's the direction of her travel. There she goes. It's a very serious thing. That cycle repeats and repeats and repeats. This is the blueprint for performance religion, for legal righteousness, for practical Gnosticism. This is a perfect formula for it. We must learn, and please listen to this sentence. Of all things I'm going to say tonight, there's nothing more important than this sentence. We must learn that love that must be earned is as false as the good deeds that earned it. We must learn that love that must be earned is as false as the good deeds that earned it. This is not really my subject tonight, but I want you to know, as pastors, as parents, that hidden or unrepented of sin in the life will cause its own neurosis. It will cause its own emotional struggles. It will cause its own hiddenness. It will cause its own darkness. It will cause its own separation. It will cause its own loneliness if there's unrepentant sin in the life. And then again, with that little girl over there, what those parents want to do with that child and what you want to do with yours is you want to create an atmosphere in your home where your child never needs to fear to come to you and tell you that something's wrong, Daddy. Something's wrong in my heart, Daddy. Something happened, Daddy, in my home, in my heart. I don't feel good, Daddy. And the child that is free to do that is a perfect child. It's a free child. That child will do well in life. The child can come and say, it's just not going very well. I would never have done that with my parents in any kind of a way. So we're going to move on here. The basic cause for hurt or for offense is rejection. Now, the word hurt, as we use it, as it was used tonight in the opening there, and as we are using it here sometimes this evening, the word hurt is not in the Bible. The word that you find in your Bible that's equivalent to the word hurt is the word offense. So I will tell you what that means in Greek. Well, that bro with a purple shirt, could you come up here, lavender, I don't know what color that is. That third boy there, you stand up here. And I'm going to ask this young man, he's standing up here, I'm going to ask him to walk down across the front of this platform. What he doesn't see is behind me in his hand, I've got a long stick. And as he starts walking, I'm going to take this stick and put it right between his legs. He's going to go flopping straight down his face on the ground. Thank you. You may sit down. That's what the word offense means in Greek. To be caused to stumble by someone thrusting a stick between your feet. If that would have been a tree root and he didn't happen to see it, he'd be a little embarrassed. He'd get up and clean the mud off or dust off his knees or his trousers and he'd keep on going. That'd be okay. No offense. But he looks over here and he sees that someone did it. Different story altogether. The feelings in that boy's mind, what he's thinking, what's going through that movie that's being played right now, is something you wouldn't want to watch. And he shouldn't have to play that movie. But that happens to us. In many things, we all, terrible, terrible, I'm sorry. We all can apologize for that. We do it to our wives. We do it to our children. We do it to our employees. We do it to the school children. In many things, we offend all. Great peace have they that love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. You don't have to be hurt. Many people are hurt. If you do that to a 3-year-old child, they might get a deep bloody if it falls on a rock when they go down on the ground, but they won't think much about it. They probably didn't even catch on to how it happened, but not at that age. Here at this point, maybe I could just very, very briefly tell you a little bit about the development of human personality. That little baby over there does not understand herself at this early age of nearly a year old. She does not know that she is an individual. She does not know that she's a unique person, different from everybody else. If there someday would be other brothers and sisters in the family, she would see all of them as the same thing. We're just, I'm here, they're there. Yeah, I have my blue dress on, she has a pink one. Yeah. And we're playing dolly right now. But that little girl grows up. That little child's alive. That child has needs. It responds to care, responds to nutrition. It learns to play, it learns to talk, it learns to do things for himself or herself. All the while absorbing the ebb and flow of life. The life of that particular family in which they live. That little child at that age does not know that other families do things different than what they do. I didn't know when I went to school that the other boys in school did not wear shirts that their mothers made out of feed bag material. That's where my shirts came from. That they went to town and bought shirts at a store. I didn't know that. I knew that by the time I was in 10th grade. I didn't know it when I was in 3rd. Personality is developing. The day comes when he's not just another Nunchwander, just another Troyer, just another Swartz. No, I'm me. I'm different from my brother. I'm younger than my dad. I'm taller than my sister. My birthday comes up in April. It's the 17th. I like when mother makes some things, but I wish she wouldn't make other things for supper. When a child was young, never thought about things like that. You put the spoon to the little baby's mouth and it went. Hang on, we're not done. A child discovers as he develops his own distinctive ways. He may sense that he's being treated differently from others in the family. Yet he has not figured out yet why that is. He just begins to notice that it's different here from here. He learns that he can do some things quite well. He becomes interested in certain aspects of work or knowledge or discoveries. Helping a child to develop is as important to your child as feeding him is and clothing him is. It is at this point when the seeds of rejection are sowed into your child's heart. When he finds out that he's a person. I was 5 years old when my brother was born. For the next 5 years, If you looked at family albums, you would find many pictures of him in that album. You wouldn't find any of me. There was a reason for that. I didn't know it when I was 5, but I knew it by the time I was 10. As the little brother got older, I'd see him standing here. There we had a little hill in the yard. He was standing on top of the hill with his little bat. And my father would stand out there and throw a ball to him, and he'd hit this ball. And he would learn to do that quite well. And I was off the distance doing something by myself. And I watched that. And he would giggle. He enjoyed hitting that ball, and he would get a lot of credit for having done so well. And the ball would be picked up and throw it again, hit that ball. He learned to do it very well. And one day it dawned on me, you never experienced that, did you? You don't know what that is. And that day, you learned who you are. You're a person different from those. So now you go to school. Public school. In school, it goes well. Instead of being at the bottom, some strange thing happens, and it's the other direction. And these teachers say, young man, there's a future for you in this life. Here comes the chief officers of the Federal Reserve Bank in the city of Philadelphia, offering you a high-paying job in the bank down there in Philly. Here comes some college entrance people offering you a scholarship for their college. Here come the offers and the awards. And, hi, Dad and Mom, how you doing? Have a good day. There's a big world out there. It's a form of mental illness. It's a form of neurosis. It's a form of emotional instability. It's a form of serious, undeveloped life in a child. That's how personality is developed. It's very, very brief. That's a long study. That's a quick one right there. Seeds of rejection. Damage done here will be carried into adulthood. Who can repair the harm done? But I want to end. This is far from finished, but we're going to stop. We're talking about why are there hurting people. But this time, I think you get some ideas, don't you? There's three men that found themselves asleep. Did you forget that? You forgot that, didn't you? There's three disciples. Jesus woke them up several times, and he said, just sleep on. It's okay. What I needed you for is now past. You cannot help me from now on. This part, I must go alone. But when I needed you, you were not there. So there was a young man in a mental hospital. He wasn't so young anymore, but he was ready to be discharged. There was an interview with the chaplain before he left the institution. How do you feel about your discharge? How do you feel about going back home? Yeah, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that when I get home, there won't be anybody at home. That is the cause. That's the worst cause. May God bless you with wisdom as you think about these things.